The other piece on the research side now is the something that we call more human-centric insights, and really understanding your consumers more broadly as, you know, as people as they travel through the world. So less trying to understand the mechanical behavior that they exhibit in the range of things that you care about, and thinking that that is a good proxy for them, period, or them as a person. You almost have to start with what motivates them as a human.
Welcome to the Audible Insights podcast, brought to you by the Insights Association, the leading voice in market research, and hosted by David Paul, CEO of Engages, and an expert in research-driven messaging, content, and stories.
Hi, everyone. This is David Paul. Welcome to the Audible Insights podcast. On this episode, guest host Paul Kirch is talking with Brian Gildenberg, Chief Knowledge Officer of Kantar Consulting. Take it away, Paul.
Today on Audible Insights, we have a high-energy interview with Brian Gildenberg, the Chief Knowledge Officer of Kantar Consulting. Brian Gildenberg is a world-renowned expert in retail insight. Now, he's frequently cited in media channels such as CNBC, The Wall Street Journal, Business Week, Bloomberg, Boston Globe, and USA, and, of course, Audible Insights, globally through China Economic Times, BBC World, and FT India. He has presented to literally tens of thousands of people throughout his 15-year-plus public speaking career. So you're in for a treat today. Let's welcome Brian Gildenberg to Audible Insights. Brian Gildenberg, welcome to Audible Insights.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Well, we appreciate you coming on. I mean, obviously, Chief Knowledge Officer for Kantar Consulting, that's a title that speaks volumes to the fact that you probably have a pretty deep understanding what's happening out in the marketplace right now from a marketing retail perspective. So let's just kind of jump in and talk about a few different things. There's one of the topics that's, I guess we'll say, near and dear to my heart because I'm a podcaster and there's so much opportunity with things like Alexa briefings and things of that nature. But Alexa's being touted as potentially a fourth retail sales channel. What are your thoughts on that, and what are some predictions for the future for things like Alexa briefs and Google Home and things of that nature?
The voice shopping experience is an interesting one in that there's been some recent stuff that's come out as of the recording of this podcast where, you know, Gartner has that wonderful curve where it talks about the the peak of enthusiasm and then the trough of disillusionment before the plateau of vaguely useful or whatever their technology layout is. I think voice shopping about 6 months ago was going through the peak intensity. Scott Galloway was talking about how it's going to be the end of brands because Amazon's only going to sell you private label batteries, and everybody was getting really excited about that. And then I think a couple of studies were just recently released that showed that very few people are in fact shopping on voice, which when you think about it, makes sense. To some degree, the entire history of 20th century shopping is basically human beings trying to get away from voice shopping. So, in 1910, if you wanted to buy something, you walked into a store and asked the shopkeeper for it, and he got it for you. And he, that time it was, he got it for you. All of modern retail has been a way, it's been an attempt by human beings to not do that. So whether it's self-service stores, the internet, catalogs, the whole nine yards has all been a way to try to get away from that as your primary interaction. For I think some pretty fundamental reasons, which are that, you know, your eyes work faster than your mouth does. So it's easier and faster sometimes to not use voice as a way to shop. That being said, I think that what you're going to come back to now is the things for which voice shopping is excellent at. And voice shopping is excellent in any situation in which you have essentially already decided what you're going to buy, but that you just need to convert. And that's where the genius of what Amazon has done with Alexa and what Google is trying to do with Google Home, where you are in essence, you know, rebuying things that you know you need and that you know you want. You don't need to do a ton of comparison or a ton of thinking about it or a ton of evaluation in that process. All you're trying to do is convert in the easiest way possible. And I think voice is going to play an enormous role in that. I think that voice shopping four more complex categories, ones where you're going to have a lot of choice or a lot of navigation. It's just not the fastest way that humans have today to process information. It'll be interesting to see how screen-aided voice, like Amazon's Alexa Show, how that works. You know, if you're able to, you know, if you're making dinner in the kitchen and you're using your hands, can you use voice as a way to navigate your way through a screen in a more efficient way? So I think voice is going to play a role in shopping, but I think it's going to play a specific role to the shopping occasions that voice lends itself best to, which are things where are, you know, relatively low intensity from a consideration set that don't take a lot of time where your hands and your eyes are doing something else.
Yeah, you know, I think about myself. I tend to use those tools more as a means of setting reminders for myself. You know, like if I'm cooking and my hands are full, I might make a note to add something to a list, but not necessarily make that purchase myself. So that's a really interesting perspective. And, you know, we're talking about Amazon here. Back in July, you'd written a really compelling article where you actually talked about Amazon's far from a destroyer of brands. And I thought this was really interesting because we think about Amazon as this behemoth. But when we really look at market share and the magnitude, there are obviously some brands out there like Walmart that absolutely dwarf a brand like Amazon. So can we talk a little bit about that piece of it and how maybe there's just a little bit of overhype currently with some of the brands like Amazon being this absolutely end-all be-all to retail shopping?
Well, at this point, it's now only Walmart that dwarfs Amazon. Amazon by the end of next year, and this depends on currency and how you think about companies like CVS, which is a $200 billion company almost, but isn't the $200 billion retail business. But Amazon by the end of next year will be the second largest retailer in the world. So now they'll be smaller than Walmart by a factor of four. And that's Walmart's pretty unique. But when you look at Walmart today in the United States and how much retail volume, well, it's still less than 10% of American retail. Amazon in American terms is just about 3.5% of American retail. Neither one of these companies is anything more than a speck in the global retail landscape. Retail is a deeply fragmented business. And it's deeply fragmented globally in that there are just not that many massive multinational retailers, particularly, you know, within the context of the, you know, the 10 largest retail markets in the world. I can't think of any retailer there's no retailer that's number one in all of them. And there are very few retailers that are close to number one or two in more than half. So fragmented industry. So yes, I think, but Amazon's within the scheme of that, Amazon is now a very large retail business. And in the US, they're an overwhelming share of e-commerce. You know, they're about half of all the e-commerce volume in the US is done on Amazon. And, go ahead, sorry.
With the uniqueness of their model, though, how they actually support a lot of small business owners who actually are selling products through there, it's definitely a unique beast in terms of a retail center, correct? Or are you talking about just purely the retail arm of Amazon?
We're when we talk about the revenue they generate, you're talking about the retail arm. That's the easiest way to calculate it. Amazon probably sells in dollar terms about 35 or 40% of what they sell in retail terms, maybe close to half through their marketplace. They sell more units through third party today than they do through their first party business. So if you just measured it in terms of the number of items sold, Amazon's marketplace is a bigger business than their retail business. Their retail business is a bigger business in dollar terms. So, but even if you gross it up and doubled Amazon's retail business, you're still looking at a business that is a smaller share of US retail than Walmart and far less than 10% of American retail.
Absolutely. So the way you and I grew up obviously is different than a way a lot of the Gen Z and millennials in terms of their shopping behaviors. But let's talk a little bit about the customer journey today. Are there some significant trends you're seeing in the customer journey?
Yeah, I think the overwhelming one is the influence that mobile is starting to have on both media consumption and increasingly in shopping behavior. I suspect that when people look back on the history of shopping, like in 2030, it's possible and maybe even likely that people look at the biggest shift that took place in the early 21st century as not being from brick and mortar to digital, but being from digital to mobile. Brick and mortar to digital isn't the weirdest shift in the world. You're still looking at a range of items on a screen and yes, different business models and all that. But from a human shopping experience point of view, you're looking at multiple items at one time and making a choice. It's a different choice, but different retailers are different too. Mobile's a fundamentally different experience. So the way in which content is consumed in mobile, the nature of scrolling with your fingers versus and seeing options sequentially rather than sort of next to each other, the power of very short form content in the mobile ecosystem through Snapchat, Instagram stories, how you create brand love in that environment is so different. And then how you convert that brand love, we suspect over time, is also going to be very different. So I think mobile is probably the single biggest driver of behavior change that we see today. And it's changing today more the way that brands reach consumers from a marketing point of view. But I think eventually, you're going to start to see app-based shopping change the way that retailers think about things like assortment and choice and promotions and all of these things today that are second nature to the retail industry because they grew up with stores and shelves and took some of that thinking and applied it to a screen. None of that really works all that well in the mobile ecosystem. So I think mobile is probably the single biggest piece. I think the other one that's, obviously significant to watch is the convenience with which I can get anything delivered to my home and the myriad solutions that exist today for buying food. And those two things have, I think, dramatically changed the relationship that consumers have to physical stores in fundamental and profound ways. So, and I think in particular, the food one, when you look at the grocery industry, the consumer's ability to get prepared food in a variety of ways at very high quality, get semi-prepared food like meal kits at very high quality, the range of choices they have from a food point of view, from a retail perspective. I think all of this is really going to dramatically then retool the retailers that sell food, which are overwhelmingly the largest retailers in America, and change the way that they work. So those are a couple of the trends.
Well, that has the biggest opportunity, at least from my experience. I find that shopping for groceries online to be a cumbersome process. Are there some things being done from a research perspective and maybe an insights perspective to help retailers or to help online retailers do a better job of serving customers?
Yeah, and I think you're going to start to see this from the food retailers in particular. If you think about general merchandise, so a lot of that is the type of shopping trip Amazon was built for. It was a bookstore first, and then it expanded into non-food. Amazon's really good at selling you one thing at a time. When Amazon's going great guns, they can sell you two or three through some pretty simple algorithms, and they're pretty good at prompting you to buy related things to things that you bought through advertising. But what Amazon's not good at is selling you 15 things on a grocery shopping trip. If you try to buy 15 things on Amazon, sometime between 13 and 14, you're going to want to hit yourself on the head with a hammer. It takes a very long time. So I think that a lot of what you're going to see the retailers are trying to compete with Amazon in the grocery space do is focus relentlessly on basket construction. How do I let you put your basket online as easily as possible? Walmart in the UK for years has let shoppers just enter a code that's at the bottom of their receipt, and that will then populate their online shopping basket with what's on that receipt. Two or three years from now, I expect through image recognition and video, you're going to be able to take a picture of your receipt, and that'll then be your grocery basket to start with. So that'll save you the hassle of building it all. And then the process of figuring out what you buy all the time, so what can be more auto, sort of what we call auto replenished, so that it's something that figures out about how long it's going to take you to go through something and then prompts you when you want to reorder it, versus getting you intelligent looks at the things that you typically buy on that trip that you may not buy every time. All of that is towards how am I going to build the right basket? So understanding the consumer affinities between items and all that's a big deal. The other practical part of baskets is that if I'm a retailer today and I'm picking 10 items off a shelf and putting that in a basket, even if you're coming to pick it up, which saves me the cost of delivery, and it still costs me money to make that basket. So understanding the profitability of these baskets is going to be really important. So being able to wed together insights around consumers and their purchase preference and the types of brands and products that they buy so that I can inject profitability into these online baskets to take them from unprofitable, labor-intensive ways to fulfill to more profitable ones. I think all of that's going to be a very rich area of research.
So, I mean, obviously, we think about shelf tests where, you know, we're simulating a real retail environment in a digital forum, but it seems like this is ripe for testing baskets and testing online shopping behavior as well. Are you seeing more and more of that happening?
Yeah, and you see, this is something that I think you'll see the Walmarts and the Krogers and the you've seen this a lot even in the UK, which is the UK and France, which are more advanced grocery markets in the US. It's an enormous amount of A/B testing that goes on in the e-commerce ecosystem to try to understand what types of messaging work, what types of promotions work to create bigger baskets, what types of meal solution type promotions work, et cetera, so on and so forth. So yes, the US for a wide variety of reasons is less developed from an e-commerce grocery point of view than some of the major markets in Europe and Asia. And I think that some of those markets have some pretty good practices already established in terms of understanding how to do that kind of basket development. And it's particularly important in the U.S. because Amazon is such a big part of the U.S. e-commerce landscape and such a dangerous competitor in the retail space. It's one of the things Amazon does less well, which is put baskets together. So it's a very good, smart, lock-in customer loyalty and defense strategy for an omni-channel retailer that knows how to sell baskets already.
That's great. Well, so, I mean, obviously, Kantar Consulting, you folks have tapped into a lot of different areas, but I think one area where research or insights has typically often struggled or has wavered at times is maybe even trying to understand the consumer to the degree that that we should. Where are some areas that we're really struggling to tap in and understand the consumer buying behavior?
Well, I would say there's two. One is I don't think the companies that are paying for research, and I don't think this one's on the research companies. The second one is one we're actively working on trying to fix. I think our clients are struggling with scoping what they're looking at appropriately. And the phrase we'll use for this is sort of putting a wide angle lens on your growth opportunities. And a wide angle lens does two things. It obviously lets you see a bigger frame of reference. So you can see growth opportunities that are coming from outside your core business. And, you know, pick your anecdote here, but whether it is, Greek yogurt or Halo Top ice cream or Kind snack bars or whatever it is, the litany of large companies that missed, small trends that became medium trends became massive trends because they were overly laserly focused on a very narrow thing is the stuff of business legend at this point. I think research should be an essential part of helping you view the landscape more broadly. And then the nice thing about a wide angle lens is that the act of using the wide angle lens makes the thing you were looking at that looked enormous right-sized. So, if you're a brand manager for a detergent company, lavender-scented detergent may seem like the biggest idea in the world. In real point of fact to your core consumer, lavender-scented detergent doesn't matter at all in the grand scheme of things. And pulling back a little bit helps you see some of the things that may matter to that consumer more significantly than you would the opportunity that looks big simply because it's a very small opportunity, but next to the entirety of your field of vision. The other piece on the research side now is something that we call more human-centric insights and really understanding your consumers more broadly as people as they travel through the world. So less trying to understand the mechanical behavior that they exhibit in the range of things that you care about and thinking that that is a good proxy for them, period, or them as a person. You almost have to start with what motivates them as a human and then figure out how your category plays a role in that. And I think that's one of the ways in which you can create more seamless conversion opportunities from a retail point of view in the digital and mobile ecosystem. I can't function as well in a digitally and mobily powered shopping world if I don't know more about the person I'm trying to target, because in all likelihood, the person I'm trying to target isn't hanging out in the Walmart app for a long period of time. You know, I have to understand them more holistically so I can convert them wherever demand is created. I need to be able to convert that demand at that specific moment. In order to do that, I need a much deeper understanding of who that consumer is, what motivates them, what inspires them, and where they draw inspiration and influence from, and where they spend their time. And that I think is something that research is going to have to get markedly better at. And that's something we're working with our clients on a lot through our human and cultural insights practice.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes back to marketing 101, the idea of creating avatars and really understanding who you're targeting. It seems like that's an area where research hasn't always done as well a job. And I know when the internet was becoming, widely used, and there was a lot of promise of always being able to access psychographic data on buyers and socioeconomic information. But it seems like that's not really morphed and progressed the way that, it seemed like it was going to in the early days. Are we moving more in that way, that we're going to have deeper insights on consumers, or is it always going to be kind of a struggle too, just because of privacy issues?
I think you'll be able to paint a richer picture of who you're trying to talk to, simply because the capabilities to combine data assets are getting infinitely better, right? So, everybody's got their data stack, everybody's got their DMP, everybody's got their, all the technology that enables that more granular look at consumers. And then I think the really interesting trick is going to be from an analytics point of view, how you use the analytics to be able to group and classify, behaviors that you're trying to focus on, but then sort of get a richer picture behind that behavior. Because what you're going to end up with are, if I'm trying to make, if I'm Kroger and I'm trying to make my click list basket more profitable, and I know that a way I can do that is finding shoppers that have a high propensity to trade up in the, ready to drink tea category, right? So making it up. So they're buying private label or a low dollar ring item. I can switch them to something with kombucha in it. Now I'm charging them $6 and making $4, and I've just taken an unprofitable basket and made it profitable. So, but in order to do that, I've got to understand much more about that person than their tea behavior. I've got to know where they're going to find out about this product, what's going to motivate them, what influences them, how much disposable income do they have, so I can figure out what the right pack size is to promote to them. All of those things that I now need to, what I would need to know in order to be able to accomplish that is just markedly broader. The nice thing is the data exists to be able to do that today. It's the real trick, of course, is that once you start combining data sets together, you end up with massive data sets that that people really struggle to get their arms around. And I think they struggle to get their arms around. We were talking about, I was talking about this yesterday with somebody, but everybody always says, oh, we got too much data now. I don't know what to do with it. It's like, well, you don't have too much data because that's, that's probably a good thing. What you have are too few hypotheses to navigate through that data to get to something meaningful. The ability to develop hypotheses and the ability to quickly and rigorously test, iterate those hypotheses so that they turn into, it's almost like A-B testing your own understanding of consumers, right? So how do you consistently and continuously A-B test your knowledge base so that it gets better and better and better, so that your consumer experience understanding just continues to, always get sharper and better. And I think today that a lot of the conventional analog rooted 20th century brands, I think, struggle with this understanding in a way that a more digitally native 21st century company kind of just gets intuitively. Like, because they've grown up A/B testing and UX testing and all that stuff, they kind of understand that the process of knowing your consumer is an iterative data-based one where you're never going to quite get it right, but you're always going to try to keep trying to get it better. And I don't think most big companies are comfortable with that.
We're talking to Brian Gildenberg, Chief Knowledge Officer of Kantar Consulting. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Audible Insights is supported by CMix from Critical Mix. CMix is a collaborative new way to create insights from Critical Mix. CMix gives you fast and easy access to survey programming and management, global target audiences and data visualization right at your fingertips, all in one convenient place. Unlike other DIY survey tools, CMix lets you decide how much or how little you want to be involved with your survey project. The Critical Mix team of experts is available to help along every step of the way whenever you need them. Visit cmix.com to get started today.
Welcome back to Audible Insights. I'm your host, Paul Kirch, and we've got guest Brian Gildenberg, Chief Knowledge Officer of Kantar Consulting. Let's jump back in. Your very own words you had mentioned in an interview I'd heard you speak on where you said more data sources requires better storytelling. And I think that's an area where the research industry, you know, on the qualitative side has always, you know, tried to do a pretty good job of storytelling. But on the quant side, you know, you got people that their whole mission is to focus on numbers and data points. Storytelling hasn't always been the strength of some of those people. So are there some things the research industry can do better there?
Oh, absolutely. and I think, the head of Kantar, Eric Salama, has said this a lot over the years about just encouraging the teams to just be brave with the data, draw conclusions, don't say things that aren't true, but, be provocative with it. And I think there's two or three big areas where research is going to need to figure out, how to piece it together. I think one, because of the way in which people that are rooted in user experience data have grown up, which is with, huge data sets of observable data where they're constantly testing and learning, and they're not doing what I would call, sort of sporadic or, incremental deep dives into that. Now, I mean, they're just kind of observing data and consistently fine-tuning it. If the story around why, what you get out of those types of deep dives, I think has to get sharper and better. So if I'm going to ask thousands of people a set series of questions, what's better about that than the observable data I can get from a million A/B tests that I can, have an algorithm figure out how to run, and that's where the story becomes important, because it's not just the individual questions that become important in that setting, but it's how the questions link together to tell a story. And I think that the great research presentations that I've been part of over the years or seen people do are the ones that, even if they're pretty quantitatively based, the way in which the quantitative argument is organized tells a story that makes you unbelievably grateful for the fact that all of those questions were asked, because you get to the end of something and there's a narrative behind it. But if it's simply one-off, this question answers this specific thing, a smart digital marketer is going to say, well, I could have UX tested that for nothing. So I think that's one of the really key elements. And I think the second storytelling element is probably less what I would call conventional storytelling, though that's important. But it's around being able to genuinely understand the business decision you're trying to influence. And I think this is a challenge that, honestly, I think that the insights professionals today on client side struggle with this as well, because their constituent who used to be the CMO is now also trying to figure out what their job is, right? So, and their CMO is spending a lot of time talking to the CTO, they're spending a lot of time talking to the chief customer officer, if retail is a big part of that world. Sometimes there's this new person called a chief growth officer that sits on top of all of them and is trying to help them sort of coordinate and plan. And I think that the partnership that you'll need with your client to help them solve their business problem, what are they trying to take your insights? What decision are they trying to influence with that? That will help tell a better, that's an incredibly important part of telling a better story as well, which is, how do I know where this information, what decision this data is going to influence? And then how do I build the narrative so that it helps the group of people make that decision, some of whom may be marketers and some of whom may not be, and really being able to make it clear how it helps sort of frame and highlight that decision.
Yeah, and I think if done right, we give the opportunity for them to help us as researchers get a better seat at the C-suite than we've had for in many organizations who've lost faith in research because, quite frankly, the days of printing off reams of crosstab reports and having them sitting on someone's shelf for a few years until they finally throw them away has not done any of us a service.
No, and I think that the I think today, ironically, the rise in the importance of facts and data and the challenge that research has had, if I just told somebody who didn't know anything about the research industry that, they would look at me like I was a Martian. It's like, well, why companies obviously are going to need people that understand research because data is so much more important than it used to be. But ironically, just because of the nature of the data that is infusing decisions today is quite different than the nature of data that research-based organizations have used. And I think this is the other piece. The storytelling has to be able to bridge the gap between what you've learned through research and what is already known in the broader data ecosystem, and being able to link those stories together in really powerful ways, I think is going to be incredibly essential, because you've got the ongoing algorithms and the rise of AI and machine learning and whatever you're going to call it is going to intensify this. Companies are going to be continuously learning at a granular user experience level about a whole host of things. And if the research is done without understanding where that knowledge base is and the decisions that that knowledge base is informing, it's going to end up, you know, as a PowerPoint deck buried in someone's hard drive, since nobody prints these things out anymore to save the environment. But yeah. So it won't be gathering dust on a shelf anymore, but it'll be buried on somebody's hard drive, never to be seen again, unless it's really thoughtfully woven into the data architecture the companies are already using as part of their ongoing learning process.
Okay, so that ties us into our final question here. Brian, I really appreciate your time today. This has been great. But so we think a lot about, we hear a lot about how Gen Z and millennials, in terms of consumer media, marketing, values they have, decision-making, you know, they've grown up with a handheld device, so they have access to information and answers in ways that we didn't have growing up. First of all, what's your take on that audience and how they're going to impact consumer behavior? And then maybe let's just tie it up with what do you consider some of the biggest opportunities for market researchers to address this and maybe do a better job of serving those people?
I think the biggest difference between – I think there's two enormous differences with, you know, quote unquote young people versus not young people. Maybe three. The first of which, and two of them are squishy things that are more cultural. The first of which is and this is particularly true of America, though you could make a similar argument in a number of other countries. The diversity of the environment that young people have grown up in is just so different than, you know, older America. You know, simple throwaway stat, but, you know, if you're 50 or older like me, America statistically is a 78% Caucasian country, 22% non. If you're under 30, it's a 52-48 split. So the diversity of a younger generation in terms of their approach to things, you know, I just try to tell people, it's like, well, and this I think has an enormous amount of impact on research, not as a functional discipline, but on companies, in terms of creating workplaces that resonate with the experience set that people that grew up in the 52-48 world know. So really thinking an enormous amount about how you, one, reach different constituencies, two, how you think about those different constituencies and how you bring that together in a whole, I think is a really important point. I think the second piece, though, from a pure what I'll call information processing point of view, the fundamental problem that younger millennials and centennials, as we call them, or Gen Zs have in their life is not they need information. It's that they need a way to filter out information. They have grown up in an ectoplasm of information that consistently surrounds them forever. Their job is filtering that to find out what's real and what's true and what's genuine. And I think that the companies that have grown disproportionately quickly have survived, thrived, or failed on their ability to act as meaningful filters into the information world. So I think often today, you know, so that a 30-something who's growing up as a business professional isn't going to go, wow, I need to know this. Let's go get more information. Their gut level reaction is, wow, I need to know this. It's out there somewhere. How do I just see it better? Like, how do I reduce clutter so I can actually see what the answer is? And I think research companies are going to need to get better at both at information filtration and at finding the great insights in the miasma of data that's already there in order to bring that home. As consumers, what that's going to change fundamentally about how they shop is their time investment they're going to make in filters that they trust that will work for them. And I think that's one of the reasons why all these conversations around Facebook and its role as a filter, the ongoing conversation that's taking place today about Twitter and its role as a filter, these are really important conversations, because if this consumer that grows up in a world where the gateway between infinitely confusing information and meaningful stuff are the filters that they choose, this question about whether these filters work or not is really fundamental and really foundational. And I think great retailers are going to do what they have always done, but do it in the digital world, which is act as great filters. And I think great brands are going to act as great filters. You know, if I am, you know, there are, you know, and media brands are starting to figure this out, right? Like, you know, how as a media brand do I create the most, you know, resonant idea of what I'm a filter for so that consumers know how I'm going to help them navigate the unlimited choices that they have? And I think that that's where I think a lot of retail. So if I looked at how it's going to impact the retail world specifically, I think a lot of what we're going to study with younger millennials and centennials is less around, they walk into a store, they're staring at a shelf, how do we influence them to make choice A or B? It's, they live in the world, they have a problem, here are the choices that were mentally available for them, what are the things that are gonna motivate them to convert to one thing over another, and where is that conversion process best going to happen? Because my suspicion is that a lot of what used to be marketing from a retail point of view won't be done anywhere near where a purchase is made, because the purchase process will be more automated, it'll be more auto-replenished, and because in the end, the blurring of the line between what used to be above the line and below the line, or the blurring of the line between what used to be top of the funnel and bottom of the funnel, I think that's the most significant impact. The ability to move seamlessly through the funnel, take parts of the funnel and automate it so that an algorithm does it, whether that's an algorithm that filters out content or blocks ads, or whether that's an algorithm that rebuys detergent when I run out of it, it's all kind of the same thing. So I know this is kind of a weird answer, but I think that the relationship between those things will really blur the line between above the line thinking and below the line thinking, and there just isn't going to be a line anymore. But if I think about Amazon, you know, Amazon today just announced that they're going to be playing, you know, video, they're going to start testing and experimenting with video ads in their mobile app. So, you know, if I'm putting a brand-based video ad in the Amazon mobile app, you know, what is that? Is that above the line or below the line spend? Who knows? Who cares? It could be effective or not, but a lot of the historic distinctions that we've used to divide up the work start to change pretty fundamentally when someone's choosing what about the top of the funnel is automatic for them or machine-driven. What about the bottom of the funnel is machine-driven? So that's the biggest difference, is that above the line and below the line are probably much less useful distinctions in that world.
Okay, so I told you one last question, but I actually am going to call myself out as a liar on that, because I have one more.
Absolutely.
So I actually own a digital marketing agency where we do some development work in the space of leveraging beacons. Now, in the beginning of mobile research, there was great promise of being able to get insights from shoppers in the moment when they're in a store. I mean, obviously, there's some reality to that, that people that are in a mobile panel can possibly have that app on their phone. But are we going to see more use of beacons or that type of technology in the research world? Or is that something that's just never really going to take off just because it does require an app on a phone or some sort of opt-in? What's the direction there?
It's hard for me to I think beacons and I think geopositioning in a store is a really useful thing to do. So I think the beacon technology itself or whatever the next generation of it is, that's knowing where someone is in a store is incredibly important. Basically, mobile marketing, because it's so much harder to market to people in mobile because the cookie architecture doesn't exist. In mobile, you're always kind of marketing to context, right? You're not marketing to who somebody is, but you're marketing to why they are where they are or, you know, where they are or what they're doing. So, and anything that I think can add to context is going to be incredibly powerful. I think as a research tool in retail specifically, you're going to have two big obstacles to that. Number one, most people don't want to spend any time in a retail store doing anything apart from shopping. They're not even sure they want to be doing that. And two, I think the retailers, as a result of that, are going to be deeply guarded about the degree to which they want non-retail points of interruption in the shopper's journey. I don't know that that's going to be something that a lot of retailers are going to sign up for voluntarily. I mean, we've both been doing shopper research off and on for years. Even getting the retailer to let somebody come in and watch people shop is something they get paranoid about because they don't want it to disrupt the shopping trip. My sense is what if the retailer app starts doing that, then you've got a problem because if it annoys the shopper and they shut off notifications, the retailer's lost their ability to talk to the shopper. If it's not the retailer's app that's open, you can only have one app open at a time. And I suspect that a lot of the retailers are going to want apps open that are much more directly linked to the shopping experience in store. So I think there are some really practical obstacles to that I could see the retailers really balking at. But in terms of using beacons to observe and track location and time and behavior and all that sort of stuff, yes. Anything that can be passively collected through beacons, I think it's going to be great. I think the active collection presents a bunch of challenges for the retailer around disoptimizing the shopping experience, which I think are pretty logical.
Yeah, we're doing some interesting things in the employee satisfaction or employee evaluation space, but I definitely agree with you 100% on the retail challenges. Hey, Brian, I appreciate you coming on. Brian Gildenberg, can you share with people how they can learn more about you?
Oh, sure. Well, I'm the only Brian Gildenberg in the world. So if you spell my name even close to right, you'll find me on Google. I think the other piece, obviously, please keep track of Kantar at www.kantarconsulting.com, which is our primary webpage to the world. We also have the Kantar Retail IQ or kriq.com, which is our retail insights platform, which a number of the big global FMCG companies subscribe to. Although oddly, a lot of the people listening to this podcast may not even know that, because a lot of those subscriptions are run through the sales and shopper marketing side of the company. You can always follow me on Twitter at @BRYANG_KR. Do a shout out on LinkedIn. If you mention Hermie on the podcast, we can link in that way. Obviously you can follow Kantar Consulting at Kantar Consulting on Twitter as well.
And you're going to bottle up some of that energy and send it my way, I'm sure. So I will look forward to that. So
it's that trade up kombucha energy drink.
Is that about what it is? I need to get some of that.
I'm just going to bring it to market. It'll cost a lot because I'm trying to improve the profitability of my basket. So
great. Hey, Brian Gildenberg, thanks again for being on Audible Insights.
Paul, thanks. Take care. Thank you for having me.
Folks, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Brian is a ball of energy, but he's packed full of knowledge and really knows what he's talking about when it comes to retail, sales, and shopper experience. And so we really appreciate him coming on to Audible Insights and sharing his insights for us today. I want to pay a special thanks to the Insights Association. Through this show and other means like the insightsassociation.org, you're going to find a lot of ways that they're advancing the insights and research industries. So we thank them for all their contributions and everything they do.
Thanks so much for listening. You can find all our episodes by searching Audible Insights on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, and by visiting insightsassociation.org/audible. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time.